From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. This month marks the second anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and that will be the main focus of today's show. Our guests today are Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, and they'll be discussing their recently released book, Terrorism and Public Health. The book describes in detail the chronology of events that faced the New York City Department of Health after the terrorist attacks and the anthrax scares that followed, and then goes on to address the importance of public health in the defense against terrorism. Then later in the show, in today's opinion piece, I will present a perspective on the progress our country has made in the last 2 years in the defense against terrorism. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. A study from the Commonwealth Fund reports that health insurance scams have become much more frequent in the last few years, as is often the case during periods of high medical inflation. These bogus insurance companies collect premiums from enrollees, but then they don't pay medical providers for the care they provide. 4 phony insurance companies are detailed in the study. These companies collected premiums from 100,000 people and then left them about $85 million of medical debt and no insurance coverage. Texas and Florida appear to be especially hard hit. In the last 2 years alone, the Texas Insurance Department has shut down 129 plans that provided phony coverage to about 20,000 people, and at least 30,000 people were impacted in Florida. The report recommends 6 steps for state attorney general's offices and insurance commissioners to take to prevent such consumer ripoffs. Many health economists attempt to calculate the administrative costs of the U.S. healthcare system, but the costs described in this study are rarely, if ever, included in tallies of the administrative costs in the United States. It would appear that the price of policing the private health insurance industry is an example of administrative costs that are unique to the United States. And the suffering and debt incurred by enrollees is also unique to our country. This report can be accessed at cmwf.org, the website of the Commonwealth Fund. The September 9th edition of the Wall Street Journal highlights the efforts of employers to reduce health insurance costs by trying to drop coverage of employees' spouses and children. One of the strategies companies have used is to increase employee premiums for family coverage out of proportion to increases in the cost of individual coverage. Another strategy has been to charge progressively more depending on family size. And another is to simply refuse to cover a working spouse who would be able to get health insurance at his or her own company. A study published by the Kaiser Family Foundation reached similar conclusion. The Kaiser study found that just in the last 3 years, workers are paying about 50% higher premiums for health insurance, and deductibles have risen an average of 60%. Overall, according to the Kaiser study, healthcare premiums rose at a higher pace this year than any year since 1990, and this increase was especially great for small employers. Many individuals in the U.S. and Europe have been concerned about the rising rate of autism among young children, which commonly develops during the second year of life. Theories have abounded as to why autism is becoming more prevalent. Affected parents have suspected the administration of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine as a causative factor, but so far, repeated studies have shown no difference in rates of autism among vaccine recipients compared to children who did not receive the vaccine. A study just released from Denmark has also exonerated thimerosal, an additive in the MMR vaccine. That additive, which contains mercury, was banned in Denmark in 1992, but the study found that rates of autism continued to skyrocket after 1992, exonerating thimerosal as a likely causative agent of autism. After years of negotiation, the World Trade Organization announced on August 30th that it will give poor nations greater access to inexpensive life-saving medicine by altering international trade rules. After several days of nonstop negotiations and speeches, the WTO reached unanimous agreement just as its meeting was concluding, after speeches by several African delegates who said that such an agreement could save millions of lives. Under the accord, poor nations will be able to import generic versions of expensive patented medicines, buying them from countries like India and Brazil without running afoul of trade laws protecting patent rights. African countries and their supporters have been campaigning for such an agreement for years, saying that moral and political arguments outweigh commercial considerations in the face of epidemics like AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. The breakthrough came in late August when the United States agreed to the same proposal it had rejected 8 months before. Backed by the powerful American pharmaceutical lobby, the Bush administration had prevented the trade organization from adopting the measure, saying it should be restricted to a handful of diseases and limited to only a few countries. The European Union and Switzerland, the other two delegations representing advanced pharmaceutical companies, however, had accepted the proposal. The United States finally agreed to the accord only after it won acceptance of an additional statement setting out measures to ensure that countries would not take advantage of the agreement and reap commercial profits rather than meet public health needs. But several public health groups, including Doctors Without Borders, opposed the agreement because they're concerned that the revised agreement imposes bureaucratic red tape that will discourage poor nations from importing these generic drugs for fear of running afoul of the WTO. The Centers for Disease Control reports that the number of West Nile virus infections this year is nearly double the number from this time last year, but fewer people have died from the infection this year. So far, over 2,900 people have been infected and 54 have died. The higher number of infections this year might be the result of earlier testing, and the lower death rate may be due to the fact that patients with milder symptoms are now being tested. Colorado has been the epicenter of the epidemic this year, with 973 human cases, and Nebraska and South Dakota have also been very hard hit. Coming up next, Victor Seidel and Barry Levy join us to discuss terrorism and public health. So stay with us. You're listening to Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. 2 years have passed since the terrorist attacks on New York City and the Pentagon. And those events, as well as the anthrax deaths that followed, highlighted the importance of the country's public health system in the response to terrorism. Recently, a number of people on the front lines of public health have contributed to an important book assessing the public health response to terrorism. The book is titled Terrorism and Public Health, and the two individuals who edited the book, Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, are joining us today on Public Health Radio. Victor Seidel is Distinguished University Professor of Social Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. Barry Levy is currently an adjunct professor of community health at Tufts University School of Medicine. His primary areas of concentration have been occupational and environmental health. Both of our guests have served as presidents of the American Public Health Association, as well as key roles in the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the organization that was awarded the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. Doctors Levy and Seidel collaborated on a previous book, War and Public Health, which documents the many impacts of war on health in many countries across the globe. both that book as well as Terrorism and Public Health, the book we're discussing on today's show, are available through Oxford University Press and can be obtained at Oxford's website, oup-usa.org. Victor Seidel and Barry Levy, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good to be here.
Glad to be with you.
First of all, I'd like to compliment you on this book. Now, the largest section of the book provides a series of public health perspectives and narratives on the terrorist events of that autumn of 2001. I'd like to start out by asking you to talk about the response of the local public health agency, the New York City Health Department.
Why don't I start off and just mention some of the things that happened? And you know, nothing like this had ever happened before. So while there was preparedness planning, a lot of things had to be made up on the spot by, in part, applying basic public health principles. There were immediate things like the city health department had to evacuate its premises. They had to devise temporary means of communication and transportation because existing communication systems, phone lines, were either out or overloaded. There needed to be some coordination of the medical response, particularly in triaging those who had survived and were injured. There were other aspects. There had to be good coordination between what was going on at the city level, you know, on the ground within Lower Manhattan, and the National Disaster Medical System that was deployed to coordinate emergency medical response. The hospitals that were waiting for seriously injured people actually turned out that there were relatively smaller numbers than anticipated who needed treatment for injuries. The ratio of people who died compared to the number who were seriously injured was huge, so that there weren't as many seriously injured people as anticipated. Provision needed to be made for special treatment for people who were seriously burned. Provisions had to be made for all the people who were displaced from their homes as a result of the tragedy. And ongoingly, the city health department had to inform the public, inform health professionals by ongoing media briefings to keep people aware of what was happening and what they should be prepared for. Vic, do you want to add more to that?
You know, one of the most important elements in the aftermath, of course, was the psychological support for the victims. And the New York City Health Department, the psychiatric and the both psychiatry and psychology networks in the city leapt into action. The Public Health Association of New York City was important in that, as was the American Public Health Association. So there were a fairly good responsive network to take care of these immediate needs.
Another area that was very important for the health department to get engaged in was dealing with the mental health of the New York community at large, and cases of anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder that evolved in the weeks that followed.
Now, one of the areas that started to get publicity perhaps a few weeks later had to do with the environment in downtown Manhattan. And I've actually picked out an excerpt from your book that I'd like you to comment on. And here it is from the beginning of the chapter on environmental health issues. The environmental aspects of the World Trade Center disaster were extraordinary. Over a million tons of steel, dust, cement, asbestos, and other debris fell to the ground. The enormous heat, up to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, from the fires and the explosion, transformed many materials like computers, carpeting, furniture, air conditioning fluid, into a gaseous cloud of potentially toxic dust, which took weeks to dissipate. And I guess I want to ask you, how did the health department analyze that kind of array of materials that could interact, and how did they go about doing that?
Well, why don't I start off with that? First of all, the health department worked in close partnership with specialists in academic institutions in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut metropolitan area, and also coordinated their efforts with national institutions that were involved, research institutions, public health, occupational health, environmental health. There was a lot to be done, and again, in a situation that hadn't occurred before. So there were systematic approaches to it. There was reasonably good coordination of people meeting together, deciding what the priorities were, what needed to be done right away to assess whether there was any imminent danger to people, and what kinds of issues were kind of longer-term research issues that were still very important but could wait a little while until they were up and going. And throughout, there was a need for keeping good communication with the public and with health professionals. Vic, do you want to comment further on that?
Another part of that was the setting up of monitoring stations, which both the health department and various academic departments around the city helped to prepare. And those monitoring stations went into service very, very quickly and were important in showing what hotspots there were, and more important, in showing that when there was little or no danger. All of this was communicated to the public in some very effective methods.
Now, I guess the last area that it's easy to ignore is that even though they're not in the regular building, they still had to carry out the usual functions of a health department. And people don't always understand some of that. And I guess the usual responsibilities became an exceptionally great amount of importance when there started being a concern about anthrax.
Well, related to that, certainly there needed to be heightened surveillance and monitoring of disease. I mean, the health department on an ongoing basis, and this doesn't make the headlines unless there's some outbreak or epidemic, but the health department, like health departments around the country, has a responsibility for monitoring the occurrence of disease. And there was a heightened need to do this in part because of the devastation that occurred with the attacks on the World Trade Center, but also because of the concern that there might be some additional terrorist attacks. You know, on top of the need for ongoing public health surveillance, as the health department always does. So that became especially important.
Bruce Lippe, who wrote the chapter on protecting the health and safety of the recovery workers, was actually fairly critical, and it sounded like that was maybe one of the least successful efforts of public health, was protecting those workers.
Well, several things. One, it was a glass that was half full and half empty. I think a lot of positive things were done. The fact that there were no deaths among the rescue workers was a phenomenal, that occurred, that there weren't any deaths, and I think that's a testament to the fact that safety on the site was relatively good. On the other hand, coordination wasn't always what it should have been, and I think some of the concerns had to do with the occupational health concerns had to do with the fact that this was a site where the remains of hundreds of thousands of people were buried in the debris, and so it was maintaining the sanctity of the site while at the same time protecting the health and safety of the rescue workers. Another issue, I think, is just kind of the macho attitude that is generally prevalent among construction workers and rescue workers and so forth, that nothing will happen to them. And so they often needed to be reminded of the inherent dangers, sometimes great dangers, that existed at the site. Two of the specific things that Bruce Lippe pointed out in his chapter had to do with the fact that the federal OSHA, that is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, was consulted but did not really enforce regulations at the site. And one can always Monday morning quarterback, so to speak, and hindsight's always 20/20. But at least in retrospect, that was a problem that perhaps could have been handled better. Another concern by a number of the unions on the site was that they were often excluded from the process of planning the deconstruction effort, so to speak. So I mean, those are two of the specific problems that had occurred.
If the people who lived a block or two or three away were concerned about smoke, dust, and vapors, and asbestos, and acid in the air, and all of those issues, the workers would be right up close and on top of that. And I was surprised from that chapter when Bruce Lippe mentioned that how few of the workers were actually wearing respiratory protection.
I think in retrospect, there should have been more enforcement of a respiratory protection, even over the objection of some of the rescue workers and the responders. That would have caused some problems at the time, but it would have led to greater protection for those workers.
Yeah, no question. One of the concerns, as you already mentioned, was the presence of asbestos in the North Tower. The first 40 floors of the North Tower, the World Trade Center, had been insulated with spray-on asbestos insulation before that type of insulation was banned, actually, during the course of the building of the World Trade Center. And so when the North Tower collapsed, not only did it emitted much asbestos into the air, but the size of the fibers, given the tremendous force of the collapse of the North Tower, led to huge numbers of very small asbestos fibers, which were easily inhaled and easy to remain in the lungs. So, and the concentrations were greater the closer one was to ground zero.
Another issue that you mentioned a moment ago was the concern that there might be another attack, another terrorist event in the city. And both the health department and the various security agencies were very concerned about that. In fact, when the outbreak of anthrax, the dissemination of anthrax, took place, this was seen as some sort of a continuation of the terrorist attack. It appears now, in retrospect, that it was not, but that was a concern at the time.
Well, why don't we move on to that? On the national news one night, I think it was early October.
That's right.
We heard that there was an anthrax death in Florida, but apparently the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, got on TV and said that, no, this is an isolated event not related to terrorism. What is your understanding of how that action on his part?
Well, the concern at the time for many of us was that Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, took over the communication when it was clear from his statements that he had little or no knowledge of the disease or of the situation. There were lots of people in the federal establishment who could have done a far better job, including both the Surgeon General of the United States and the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but they were not permitted to take the center stage in dealing with these issues. And I think communication suffered because of that.
I think they finally came to their senses a couple of weeks later after a lot of miscommunication and lack of communication had occurred, and I agree very much with Vic that it's important for the leaders in public health to be the ones and the ones who have the information and the experience and the knowledge to be communicating on issues such as an anthrax outbreak like this.
Well, let's take a short break. I'm Marvin Malik. This is Public Health Radio, and my guests today are Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, and we've been discussing their recently released book, Terrorism and Public Health. In the second part of the interview, we discussed the response of the public health sector to the anthrax outbreaks and how the 2 years that have passed since the terrorist attacks have affected the overall capacity of the public health sector to respond to terrorism as well as to SARS and many other potential threats to public health. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guests today are Victor Seidel and Barry Levy, whose book, Terrorism and Public Health, is the subject of today's show. Back to the interview. So go ahead and describe what the public health response was to the anthrax outbreaks.
Well, I think there are basically three parts to it. One was surveillance of cases, and that was conducted in a number of ways, as public health officials routinely do, heightening awareness among physicians and other caregivers to report cases immediately to state and federal health authorities, getting laboratories, state laboratories, and also the state public health laboratories and the Centers for Disease Control very much involved in making sure that accurate diagnoses were being made, and also obtaining environmental samples, and then investigating the outbreak, that is, putting all this information together to try to trace the source of it, to see if there were additional cases occurring elsewhere, and all along to brief the public and health professionals about what more needed to be done.
The issues here were also that the way in which the anthrax was discovered, both initially in Florida and some of the other outbreaks, the other disseminations, was the result of careful work by practitioners, by medical care practitioners. And all of the current talk about syndromic surveillance would have not had much effect at the beginning of that outbreak. So what is needed is a very good medical care system, so that when people turn up with strange exotic diseases with symptoms that are difficult to explain, the medical care system is geared up to deal with it. That requires a medical care system much better organized, much more available and accessible to the public than our current medical care system is.
What one of the realities that Vic is alluding to is the fact that one out of every six people, and in fact we look at longer periods of time, even higher numbers, in the United States are without easy access to health care. That is, they don't have any health insurance coverage of any kind, and many more of us are underinsured. And so these are people who, even if they have symptoms that might be suggestive of anthrax, they may not know that, but they're less likely to seek medical care even in a situation like this. In addition, another important medical and public health aspect of this outbreak and control of the anthrax outbreak was assessing people with throat swabs and nasal swabs to see if they were carrying anthrax, and of course many people were found out that they were, but also giving prophylactic or preventive medication with various types of antibiotics, so that people who might have been carrying the anthrax organism or may have been exposed could have preventive treatment. And as Vic is stating, you know, all this kind of medical care is inhibited in a country where one out of every six people is without some kind of health insurance coverage. Another aspect of what happened during the anthrax situation, during the anthrax outbreak, was that there were lots of scares all around the country, where you know, white powder turned up on a plane and it was thought to be anthrax, and it turned out to be sugar, but it had to be treated with caution and analyzed to determine you know, what it really was. And these kinds of scares or false alarms occurred throughout the country. One doesn't know an alarm, you know, whether it's false or not until one investigates. And so police and fire department officials, public health officials, and many other people turned their attention to investigating these alarms, all of which turned out to be false alarms, but nevertheless had to be investigated. And that took a huge amount of resources away from other kinds of day-to-day activities that, you know, are also very important.
One of the striking things from your book was the description of Akron, Ohio, where they apparently were having a Shigella outbreak in many daycare centers, but the lab could no longer continue investigating for Shigella because they were getting so many requests to analyze specimens for anthrax. Remarkable.
Yes, and on a small scale, that's a concern that Vic and I and many, many other people in public health share, that at a time where there's heightened alert to possible terrorist attacks, that we need to make sure that a balance is maintained from, on the one hand, preparedness for the possibility of terrorism, but also all the other health problems that exist, the real health problems that exist day in and day out that public health resources need to be attending to, from tobacco-related disease, which takes 1,000 lives every day throughout the whole year. More than 400,000 people die of tobacco-related disease, alcohol, infectious diseases like the shigellosis outbreak, chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes, cancer. We need to be able to make sure that the public health resources, as meager as they are used to address the most important problems. And a lot of the response to terrorism preparedness and so many of these false alarms has really drawn resources away, with initially those resources being barely adequate to address the public health needs.
The total of the anthrax outbreaks over that entire autumn was 18 cases requiring hospitalization and 5 deaths. So on the one hand, you could say, well, that such an incredible diversion of resources went to anthrax is sort of a shame because there wasn't really that much to it. But maybe on the other hand, the public health people did a good job of analyzing the mail and the buildings where the mail was. And so it's, in that sense, you could think of it as a success that so few people were affected. How do you think about that?
And I don't think either of us would say that that was an over-response. I mean, we're dealing with a situation, theoretically, one of those envelopes addressed to Senator Leahy, which I think was the most refined preparation of the anthrax, the last of the several letters that were sent, you know, theoretically could have killed 5-10 million people if, you know, that those anthrax spores were evenly distributed and lots of people were exposed to enough to kill them. So it's hard to say that one cannot say, I don't think, that we over-responded. But I think what it was an illustration of the fact is that the public health system in the United States has been so long neglected and so underfunded that when we did respond, and all the resources or many of the resources of CDC and several state and city health departments were directed just to the anthrax investigation and control of the anthrax outbreak, it stripped bare the resources that are needed for so many other public health problems, as we were saying a little while ago. So I don't think one can fault the anthrax response, the investigation of pouring too many resources into it. And I think it was a success. I mean, when you think about how many letters were sent and what each one of those letters could have brought about in terms of illness and death, it's remarkable that there were only 5 deaths. And I think in the end there turned out to be 22 cases.
Looking back on the responses of the public at large to the events of the autumn of 2001, what are your thoughts on the responses of the public to the terrorist attacks and the events that followed?
Let me just comment on 3 things real quickly. One is that despite the fact that there were some instances of people inappropriately behaving, like people in distant parts of the country buying up ciprofloxacin, the antibiotic, one of the antibiotics to protect against anthrax, for the most part, the public did not panic, and for the most part, the public behaved appropriately and very admirably. A couple things that the public did and health professionals did was volunteer their services in their own neighborhoods, and also people came from all over the country to volunteer their assistance in Lower Manhattan and elsewhere. So it was, I think, an extraordinary outpouring of the best of humanity that occurred in response particularly to the attack on the World Trade Center.
In the United States, conventional wisdom is that everything government does, it does ineffectively and wastefully, that we get no benefit from paying for these services, so we should just cut taxes as much as possible. And we've even been seeing that play out just in these last few months. But when I think of the events of the autumn of 2001, it seems that the citizens were just enormously grateful for the heroism of the rescue workers, and we're very appreciative of the generally fine performance of the health department. And on the other hand, when there were deficiencies, such as Tommy Thompson's inappropriate reassurance about the Florida anthrax case, people really, really regarded that as totally unacceptable. And this picture seems to indicate to me that people have the expectation that their government will not only be there for them in bad situations, but that it will perform very well. Do you feel that there's a contradiction here, that politicians are able to get elected attacking government, always attempting to cut government programs and taxes, but when crises arise, the public not only expects government to be there to help them, but to really perform at a high level?
Yes, well, I mean, I think as you're implying by your question, you know, so much of the anti-government fervor is propaganda put out by people who want to, on ideological grounds, want to cut the size of government. In fact, the vast majority of people in the United States, when they have various kinds of needs, be it public health or other kinds of needs that the government can best fulfill, they look to the government to provide those services, and they want to assure that those services are provided in a timely and comprehensive and quality manner. So I think there is a divergence there in terms of the kind of propaganda that gets put out often by politicians who want to reduce the size of government, and the vast majority of people who indeed believe that government services are necessary.
Now, you mentioned that since the terrorist attacks, and especially with anthrax, which obviously directly involves public health, that there's been more public recognition that public health is part of the response to terrorism. So 2 years now just about have passed since 9/11. Have things improved overall in the public health sector?
As Barry used the analogy earlier, the glass is both half full and half empty. There has indeed been a fair amount of new resources poured into public health. Much of that has been done under the rubric of dual use. That is, somehow was expected that the public health departments who received these new riches would use those funds not only for preparation for bio or other terrorism, that they would also be used to expand laboratories, train personnel, and other kinds of ways. And some of course, that has been true. But on the other hand, it's been a diversion for these public health departments. It has caused personnel to be moved from duties which were very necessary for them to do to other duties which were unnecessary or didn't really require anything being done at the moment. So it was a very much mixed bag. And on the whole, people are beginning, and public health are beginning to be concerned that some of this funding and some of the way in which it's been used is actually dysfunctional. Example of the diversion of resources, of course, is smallpox. There's not been a case of smallpox, a natural case of smallpox in the world for over 20 years, and yet an enormous amount of resources have gone into smallpox vaccination and other kinds of planning for smallpox. Now, there indeed needs to be some stockpiling of smallpox vaccine materials. There needs to be some planning. But for the President of the United States to roll up his sleeve and permit himself to be vaccinated when there wasn't a chance in the world of his being a first responder to a smallpox outbreak was a travesty. It was worse than a travesty. It was an example of putting people at risk who did not need to be put at risk. And we're now beginning to learn that many of those vaccinated are now suffering adverse consequences from the smallpox vaccination. And it's an example, as Barry was saying earlier, of the way in which the approach to bioterrorism, of preparation against bioterrorism, prevention of bioterrorism, has got to be balanced rather than the kind of an approach that is scattershot, that wastes resources, and which is dangerous.
And going back to the water in the vessel or water in a glass analogy, as more water has been poured in with bioterrorism preparedness funds, even more water has gone out the bottom of the glass. The glass is leaking, you might say, because of the budgets, particularly at the state and local level, that have been shrinking considerably in the last several years because of the state of the economy. And so on balance, many state and local health departments are really having fewer resources than they had 2 years ago because of the state and local budget crises.
Many political pundits have been saying that the events of 9/11 have helped President Bush define his presidency. The terror attacks seem to give the president a sense of direction and purpose. So I'd like to ask you to evaluate the response.
It seems to me that if we want to control terrorism in the world, if we want to reduce terrorism, there are very many things that the richest, most powerful country of the world can do to reduce the threat of terrorism. Some of it is to provide development aid to poor countries of the world, to reduce the ways in which people feel desperate, in which people become suicide bombers because they have relatively little to lose. But the United States has simply not done that. It is one of the lowest contributors to poor countries in terms of development aid, apart from military aid. So if we would use our priorities as a rich country, we would try to deal with the dangers of terrorism by providing ways in which the quality of life around the world would get better.
Well, I think the one other thing is to the extent that we want to be effective in preventing terrorist acts, we need to become more of a partner in the international community. We need to work through the United Nations and through other kinds of international bodies. We need to be joining rather than withdrawing from international treaties. We need to be seen as a participant in the affairs of our global village. And I think it's in our enlightened self-interest as a nation to be doing all those things rather than becoming more isolationist, despite the fact that we have the strongest military by far in the world. No one doubts that. But for us to be really effective in maintaining our strategic interests and also maintaining what this country is all about in the first place, the principles as reflected in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence and other core aspects of our history and our lives in this country, we need to be more cooperative and more participatory in the business of the world and the affairs of the world, and that means working through the United Nations and other international agencies rather than withdrawing from those agencies and sometimes undermining their activities.
I'd like to point out to listeners that though we don't have time for more on today's show, there's really much more in the book. We barely touched on the sections that deal with weapons and also this section assessing the overall ability of health departments to deal with terrorism and protect the public and the food and water supplies. So tell us, where is the book available?
There are two ways, both to get in touch with Oxford University Press. There's a 800 number, a toll-free number. It's 1-800-451-7556. Or they can go to the Oxford University Press website. That's www.oup-usa.org. And the name of the book, again, is Terrorism and Public Health.
Well, Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Sure, our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, a comment on terrorism and public health 2 years after 9/11. So stay with us. On September 7th, the president spoke to the nation about the war on terrorism. On the second anniversary of the terrorist attacks, it was appropriate for the president to reflect on how the war on terror was progressing. His speech was telling. Nearly the entire half hour was spent explaining how we had taken the offensive against terrorism across the globe, had killed or captured 2/3 of the leadership of Al-Qaeda, and we would continue on the offensive against terrorists no matter where they may be hiding out. Only 3 days before the terrorism speech, the president made an appearance at the opening ceremony of the National Football League. Thinking about the two events It occurred to me that perhaps football provides useful lessons for those who are directing the war against terrorism. Everyone who follows football knows that any team which focuses exclusively on offense is guaranteed to lose the game every time. The president's half-hour-long talk included only 7 words on the defense of the country. And this has been reflected in his policies. While massively increasing the size of the military and invading 2 countries far across the globe, our country's defense against terrorism is probably weaker now than it was before 9/11. Our borders are almost as porous as they were. There is no inspection or monitoring of any kind for well over 90% of cargo containers entering the country. In fact, about a month ago, ABC News hired a ship in Indonesia, loaded up a cargo container with more than enough radioactive material to create a dirty bomb, and shipped it to the U.S. It entered the country without a single inspection or impediment of any kind. Airport security is not faring that much better, with continued surreptitious inspections revealing that knives and other potential weapons continue to make it through airport security most of the time. Despite this, on May 4th of this year, the Department of Homeland Security announced that 20% of the airport security personnel hired to make the skies safer were to be laid off over a 4-month period. The economic recession has meant that tax revenues have dropped sharply in nearly every state. This has led to layoffs in the numbers of public workers across the country. But virtually all first responders to emergencies, including terrorist attack, are public sector workers. From Buffalo, New York, to Houston, to Los Angeles, the number of police officers, rescue workers, and firefighters has been dropping. Remarkably, even New York City now has fewer police officers and firefighters than it had prior to September 11, 2001, even though it doubtless remains a prime target for terrorist attack. On today's show, we discuss the fine book Terrorism and Public Health, which describes in detail the many ways that public health is an integral part of the response to terrorism. Public health will serve on the front line of the effort to identify and protect the public against chemical or biological attack, as well as any radiation attack, such as a dirty bomb. In addition, in these, as well as an attack by conventional weapons, the public health sector will be called upon to organize the medical response, as well as to assess and remediate the environmental health risk to rescue workers and residents in the vicinity of an attack. Within the public health sector, the Bush administration's response to the threat of terrorism has been to undertake a mass vaccination program against smallpox. On the other hand, key elements of the public health response to terrorism, epidemiologic surveillance, and the development of adequate lab facilities to effectively serve the country in time of emergency, have received minimal assistance, with the exception of a few demonstration projects. Facing sharp declines in state tax revenues, these programs have not fared well, since they always seem more optional than staffing prisons and keeping school systems and the Medicaid program afloat. So goes the public health response to terrorism. The expert panel that develops most standard recommendations for immunization practice in the U.S. is called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. After a year of deliberation, the panel published its recommendation, and they recommended that smallpox vaccine should be available around the country in case of an unforeseen emergency. And the panel recommended that each state designate one or more small teams which would be deployed in the event of a suspected smallpox outbreak. These teams would receive the vaccine. This was a vastly more limited proposal than the Bush administration's directive that virtually all doctors and nurses receive the vaccine. A few days later, Julia Gerberding, the Bush administration's appointee to head the CDC, took the unprecedented step of coming out publicly opposing the advisory committee's smallpox recommendation. Never before has the head of the CDC taken a public position opposing the recommendation of an expert panel on immunization. A substantial portion of additional funds that the federal government has provided to public health departments has been earmarked for the smallpox vaccination campaign. But on average, these funds have barely offset budget cuts that strapped state governments have imposed on health departments. Preparation for that vaccine program against smallpox has required a good deal of work and expense. Fortunately, however, the burden on health departments has been lightened by the fact that the aggressive smallpox vaccine initiative holds such low regard in the medical community that more than 92% of medical personnel targeted for vaccination have chosen not to get the vaccine. When one compares the offensive strategy of the Bush administration to a more balanced approach, several things are worthy of note. If we were to overdo things on the side of defense, almost all the consequences are favorable. If we hire more airport screeners or cargo inspectors, we'll end up with better quality inspections, or we'll get passengers and cargo through the queue faster. If we hire more police officers, firefighters, or other first responders, they will be there to respond to all types of threats, fire, crime, and many others, and not only to terrorism. If we invest generously in public health, we would not only have a more solid capacity to respond to a bioterror attack, but also to routine epidemics such as dysentery, or the next novel epidemic such as West Nile, or Lyme disease, or SARS. Furthermore, virtually all expenditures in these programs to defend the country are adding employees in the U.S., giving a direct benefit to the economy. On the other hand, heavy use of military strategies, as we've already seen, carries mostly risks and downsides. In military conflict, civilian casualties, destruction of infrastructure, shortages of food, electricity, and other basics of life are predictable. War is expensive, and war is not popular. It's not popular in the U.S., and it's even less popular abroad, where in many areas the cultural memory of war is much more recent and poignant than it is here in the U.S. On September 12, 2001, a remarkable thing happened. All over the world, from the Orient to Australia to Toronto, people spontaneously gathered to express solidarity and support for those who suffered and those who lost loved ones in the U.S. Especially large crowds gathered in Paris and in London. Perhaps most remarkable was the large gathering that took place in Tehran, the capital city of Iran. That was remarkable both because the Iranian government allowed the event to occur and because so many Iranians felt a common human bond with Americans who had suffered such a terrible loss the day before. 2 years later, that wellspring of good feeling and sympathy for the U.S. has completely run dry. The Bush administration's insistence on waging war on Iraq was only the last in a series of U.S. policies that alienated people across the globe. Months earlier, the administration released a report that reevaluated our nuclear arsenal. The report recommended developing small nuclear weapons whose use would be more realistic than would be the use of larger nuclear weapons. Or at least using them seemed more realistic to those who came up with the proposal. It may not have seemed so realistic to the rest of the world. More dramatic yet, the administration listed 7 countries as potential targets for these weapons. This list included several non-nuclear nations, as well as Russia and China. we've withdrawn from several international negotiations, including treaty negotiations to ban weapons in space, to limit anti-ballistic missiles, to support a global court for international war criminals. And we've undermined progress at several international events of major concern to global public health, including undermining the UN Population Conference in Bangkok last year, discussed on an earlier edition of this show, and also the Tobacco Control Treaty. The Bush administration also chose to withdraw support from the UN Population Fund. We withdrew from the international treaty to safeguard the health and safety of children as well. These actions of our government are largely ignored by the press in the United States, but receive much more coverage abroad and contribute to the image that America acts only in its self-interest. And our willingness to invade Muslim countries betrays a casual attitude towards loss of life and property among Muslims that they just don't share with us. The Pew Charitable Trust has undertaken a series of polls that included 66,000 people in 49 countries across the globe over the last few years. Those researchers found that America is now viewed unfavorably by the people of virtually every country, from Europe to the Middle East to East Asia and Africa. Results of that poll are available at pewtrust.com. This matters. We are not safe from terrorism when the level of ill feeling against the U.S. is so massive. Even if only a small percentage of those abroad who dislike U.S. policy have the anger and desperation to become terrorists, when the entire norm of opinion in so many countries is so intensely anti-U.S., we have much to fear. If this doesn't change, we can take out every member of Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and Hussein's entire entourage, but the next generation of terrorists will be larger than the current one. To improve our image abroad, how about undertaking a meaningful humanitarian aid program? Improving public health, access to untainted water, and nutrition in the poorest nations of the world. Despite the dramatic statements at his most recent State of the Union message, very little aid has in fact been approved by Congress to address the international AIDS crisis, the greatest public health disaster since the Black Death 7 centuries ago. A selfish reason to undertake a major international public health aid initiative would be to reverse the anti-American sentiment, which has grown so much in the last 2 years. Dollar for dollar, such a program would do far more to prevent another generation of terrorists than the military tactics which have been highlighted so far. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.